The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Thanks so much for coming. I have a couple books I want to give away for free. First, is anyone in here a Jonathan Edwards fan? Oh, there we are. Okay. It's for you then. Okay. This is his book, Charity and Its Fruits. And it's all on love and the nature of love. And central to my understanding of productivity and leadership is actually love. I think we need to understand the Christian doctrine of love in order to understand how to lead. So as I was preparing to write my book, I did a lot of research on love, especially in Jonathan Edwards' book, Charity and Its Fruits. So let me pass this book back to you. This is one of the best books on love that's out there. So a little bit about me. I worked at a ministry called Desiring God for about 13 years. It's John Piper's ministry. Has anyone heard of John Piper? So I worked there for about 13 years. The last, I think, 5 or so years, I was director of strategy. And it's like, what is that? What is that even a real job? Who can be director of strategy? And what that job consisted of was developing leadership philosophies and systems for the whole organization. And I fell into that because prior to that role, I was in charge of the website department, and I redesigned the whole website on the basis of principles of usability. And then they said, why don't you do what you did for the website for the whole organization? And I said, okay, that sounds great and exciting task. And it was way larger of a task than redesigning the website. So I kind of got in over my head. But while doing it, I learned a ton and did some deep dives into researching not only how to lead, but how to do it in a gospel-centered way, how to identify the biblical foundations behind good leadership and then create the systems that will embody those throughout the organization. So that's how I started learning about leadership. And then just recently, last year, I came out with this book. This is my first book, What's Best Next? How the Gospel Transforms the Way You Get Things Done. And it's on personal productivity. But today we're talking about leadership, which is important for all sorts of reasons. It's important for people who care about productivity because your productivity won't even scale, actually, unless you understand leadership. Personal productivity can make you individually productive, but you can only have a large-scale impact really through leadership. So we need to understand how to lead. The unfortunate thing is that a lot of times Christian organizations aren't necessarily led well. There may be great intentions there to lead the organization well, but sometimes there's a shortage of the actual know-how of how to lead. And the thing is, knowing how to lead doesn't come instinctively. We can't just sit back, reflect, and say, let's see, how do you lead? And then jot down what comes to mind, and we're off and running and doing it right. Learning how to lead, it's like learning how to read. Everyone is built in some degree to be capable of doing it, but you have to learn the skill from outside yourself. You have to learn grammar. You have to learn syntax. You have to learn vocabulary to learn how to read. Same with math. You have to learn it from outside of yourself. You can't just learn it from reflection. And I don't think we've really appreciated that about leadership. And I think that's one of the reasons the church is sometimes behind in its views on leadership and in its implementation of good leadership practices. So I want to help bring good leadership practices into the church, into Christian organizations. But I don't just want to take what the secular researchers have found and baptize that and bring that in. I want to think about leadership biblically, with the Bible as my ultimate guide, thinking about leadership from the ground up from the scriptures, and then utilizing the best of secular thinking when it aligns with the scriptures. So that's what I try and do. I am not a fan of just tacking verses on to leadership principles superficially when the verse has nothing to do with the leadership principle. I'm not about that. I'm about taking leadership and saying, what does the Bible teach about it? The same way we do that with any doctrine, whether it be the Trinity or the two natures of Christ. We go down, we dig deep into the scriptures, and we see what they have to say. And interestingly, the Bible actually has a lot to say about leadership. And it's very significant. And it's important for all of us to know, whatever your role is, whether you're a teacher, whether you're an administrator, whether you're an administrator and a teacher, everyone here needs to understand leadership and understand it well. If you're a teacher, you need to understand it for a couple of reasons. First, you're actually a leader. Teaching is a form of leadership. I picked up this book a few years ago called Teaching as Leadership because I love the title. I love the combination. And this book, they research the practices for Teach for America. Has anyone heard of Teach for America? They go into inner city schools and help the poor and low income students thrive. And they studied what makes for the most effective teachers. And interestingly, they found that the practices of effective teaching align with the practices of effective leadership. And that's why they call it teaching as leadership. Teaching really is a form of leadership. You're developing people's, students' character, knowledge, insight, judgment. Those are all leadership qualities. The essence of a leader is someone who doesn't just go out and do what they're told. That's not leadership, that's order following. The essence of a leader is someone who takes initiative. They are self-directed under God and able to make change. They don't just look at the status quo and say, let's leave it as it is. They say, what needs to change? They don't change just for the sake of change. That's useless and not helpful. But they change what needs to be changed. And in order to do that, they need to be independent, critical thinkers. Teachers exist in part to develop that type of person. So the more effective you are as teachers and administrators, the better leaders we're going to have in society. There's another reason teachers need to understand leadership, even if they're not administrators in their school, and it's so that they can support practices of good leadership. They need to be advocates for good leadership principles, and if you don't know good leadership principles, you can't advocate for them. And of course, administrators obviously need to understand leadership because they are creating the context in which everybody exists in the institution. So you're either going to create a healthy environment or an unhealthy environment. And a lot of times that results not from mere intentions, but good intentions coupled with intelligent action. So you need to understand the principles of leadership in order to create a thriving environment that serves the students and serves the people. And of course, and this is often overlooked, Jesus wants us to understand leadership. There is actually a Christian doctrine of leadership. And if we wanted to, nobody's done this yet, but just as we've summarized the central theological truths of the faith, the Trinity, the two natures of Christ, justification by faith alone, we could do that with leadership as well, because the scriptures are very clear on how God wants us to lead. So Jesus wants us to understand leadership. And of course, that's right here in this classic text on leadership, Matthew 20, which we're going to be looking at quite a bit and coming back to. But just for now, let me point out, he talks about leadership in the same breath as the atonement, the gospel, the central truth of the Christian faith. And he actually grounds the way we are to lead on the basis of the gospel. So leadership is really important because it apparently has gospel implications. The way we lead reflects something about the gospel, and that's why it is most important. That is the most important reason of all for us to understand leadership, because the way we lead, the way we use authority says something about God. And if we don't understand how to lead well, we are sending the wrong message about God, and that will cause people to stumble in their faith. You will be an obstacle to people growing in their faith and following Christ if you do not know how to lead well. So the stakes are high. Conversely, if you do know how to lead well, you will be giving a good impression of God. You will be sending the right message about God, and that assists people in growing in their faith. Don't be the type of the person that is an obstacle between people and God. Be the type of person who points people to Christ effectively through your words and deeds. Because that's the way we bring the gospel to the world. That's the way we grow up Christians and students in the faith. It's not just through our words, though that's essential. It's through our deeds as well. It's through demonstration as well as proclamation. And good leadership is a way of demonstrating the gospel in action, of showing what the gospel is, of sending the right message about God. So this is incredibly important, yet often overlooked. We need to understand leadership as Christians, and on the basis of correct principles, and on the basis of the gospel. Now, right now, there's a movement in the church that's really hot and trendy right now, gospel-centeredness. And I think that's awesome, because I love gospel-centeredness. But when anything becomes popular, it can fall down into a buzzword, a mere buzzword. And then people end up, they don't take it seriously, they just dismiss it. It's just become a buzzword to them. So that's why it's really important we actually understand what gospel-centeredness is. And we especially need to understand it if we're going to understand leadership from a Christian perspective, because understanding leadership from a Christian perspective means understanding it in light of the gospel. So if we're going to understand leadership in light of the gospel, we first of all need to know what it means to be gospel-centered at all as a Christian. And that's the first point on your outline. And there's three things it means to be gospel-centered. First, it means you look to Christ crucified and risen alone for your acceptance with God. You do not seek acceptance with God on the basis of your works, whether works done before you become a Christian or after you become a Christian. No good deeds or even character traits at all are the means or basis of our acceptance with God. Christ alone, his work outside of us, dying and rising for our sins, is the basis of our acceptance with God. And the means of receiving that is faith alone, not works. That is at the heart of Christianity. That is at the heart of what it means to be a Christian. So a gospel-centered Christian, first and foremost, believes that. But second, it also means once you realize you're accepted by God, apart from your works, it changes your whole mindset towards your works. It means you no longer have to do good works to gain your fulfillment or your ultimate sense of security and meaning, because your sense of security and meaning is now in Christ. It's in the gospel, not what you do. So now, as Martin Luther pointed out, you're free to do good in a way that is truly disinterested. That is, in a way that seeks your neighbor's good rather than your own good. Jesus spoke of giving without thought of return. If we had to do good works to be justified before God, we could never do good works without thought of return in a truly disinterested way, because we would always have the ulterior motive of securing our salvation, of securing our justification. Because we know now God accepts us apart from our works, we're free to do good works truly and fully for the benefit of others, to the glory of God. We are free, in other words, from being second-handers. So John Piper talks about Ayn Rand in his book Desiring God. Piper's arguing we should seek joy in doing good, which I absolutely agree with. And then Piper says, but you know, we all know some people. They're out there. They're trying to help. And there's something doesn't seem right about it. And the reason it doesn't seem right is they're trying to help not because they're ultimately interested in your own welfare as an end in itself, but they're trying to fill up some vacuum in their heart. They're in other words, they're trying to serve you as a way of ultimately serving themselves, whether making themselves feel better about themselves, whether making themselves feel important or whatever. It's ultimately about them, even when they're doing good works. Being gospel-centered means you don't have to do that. You already have all the security, acceptance, meaning, and purpose you could ever dream of in Christ. And then there's a third aspect of being gospel-centered, and this is what gets overlooked all the time. Seriously, it's constantly overlooked, and I think that's a big deal. I think it's a big, big problem. And it's this. A gospel-centered Christian is radically devoted to the good of others. Radically devoted to the good of others. Now, why is that central to being a gospel-centered Christian? Because that's the ethic of the gospel. This is the way Jesus talked about his journey to the cross, even right here in Matthew 20. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So what is the ultimate way Jesus served us? By dying for us. His death is at the heart of the gospel, his death and resurrection. And since his death was an act of service for us, meeting our ultimate needs for forgiveness in a relationship with God, Jesus' ethic of serving and putting priority on the needs of the other person is at the center of why we even have a gospel. And Jonathan Edwards makes this great point in his sermons, lots of his sermons, especially, I think, The Duty of Christian Charity to the Poor. He speaks of something called the rule of the gospel, and it's fascinating. In exhorting us to be generous in giving to the poor, he doesn't only look at the law, which is really helpful to do, and there's lots of great passages on that and commands, but he also looks, and he looks first and foremost, actually, and chiefly at the gospel, at the way Christ died for us. And he speaks of the rule of the gospel. And what Edwards is getting at is this. The gospel is not only the means by which we are saved, but also the wisdom that shows us how to live. So if you want to know how to live, you look to the gospel. You look to what Christ did. And at the heart of the gospel is this ethic of service. We see it right here in Matthew 20 and in Philippians 2, where Paul speaks of Christ, who was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself. He became a servant, being found in the likeness of men. And he submitted to his Father for our sake, even to the point of death on a cross. So this service ethic is at the heart of how Jesus thinks and operates. So if we want to echo the gospel and Jesus and the way we live our lives, we have to have service at our heart and core as well. Not to gain acceptance with God, but because we have been accepted with God. So gospel-centered Christians should be known as the most loving people in the world. Just like Jesus was. Just like Jesus was proactive and energetic in meeting the needs of others, we ought to be proactive and energetic in meeting the needs of others. Jesus said, "Love one another as I have loved you." So this is central to being gospel-centered and a gospel-centered Christian. It needs to become our dominant mindset in life. I love the way Charles Spurgeon put it. He says, "Let us go about the world with our eyes and ears open, and let us not be content until we are useful." Useful. Let us make this the main design and ambition of our lives. That is to be the chief purpose of our lives and the chief guiding principle by which we decide what to do. Now, the gospel is to affect everything. As Tim Keller says, the gospel changes everything. And we need to examine every area of knowledge and practice in light of the gospel, because the gospel gives us a comprehensive worldview. And that means we need to do that with leadership as well. So if we want to know how to lead as Christians, we need to know what gospel-centered leadership looks like. We need to apply the gospel to leadership. So what does it look like when we do that? As you could probably guess, since I'm arguing that service is at the heart of how the gospel calls us to live, the heart of gospel-centered leadership is going to be service. Some people have probably heard of servant leadership. I think that's very biblical. One time I tweeted about servant leadership, and some guy responded saying, "Oh, you're just being taken over by postmodernism." Simon Greenleaf, the guy who wrote the classic book on servant leadership, you know, was probably not a Christian. He was just speaking back the error of his day, the atmosphere of his day, and you're just being postmodern to affirm servant leadership. I think that's totally wrong. I think Simon Greenleaf was articulating certain principles that are true via common grace. He didn't get everything right, but he was seeing things that are true. And as Christians, we are to read the Bible and the Book of Common Grace. And there are lots of other people who have spoken on servant leadership and contributed to the field and refined the concept. But most of all, I think it's capturing things that the Bible is getting at and the Bible fills out more fully. And so I think it is a helpful term, though I'm defining it, first of all, biblically, not from the secular literature, though I think that is helpful. So I think servant leadership is the main implication of the gospel for leadership. Here's the way I would put it. This is the heart of servant leadership. And if you want to take one thing away from this, it's this. The essence of gospel-centered leadership is to use any power, authority, and influence you have for the good of those you lead. For the good of those you lead. There's a great book on humility out there by, what's his name, John Dixon, I think it is. And he defines humility as holding your power for the good of others. And I think that's a helpful overlapping concept here, because humility is central to the Christian life. And it's interesting the overlap between humility and service. But when it comes to leadership, when it comes to authority, when it comes to power, since as Christians we are to be in the world for others, not first ourselves, that means when we have power and influence, when we have leadership, we are to hold that for the good of others, not first ourselves. And in one sense, this seems utterly obvious, right? Who would disagree with that? And what I notice is whenever I talk about this, most people say, of course I agree with that. And then they go away and do the exact opposite. So something's off here. Something's going wrong. We think we are gospel-centered in our leadership, but really aren't. And I think that's because of a failure to think deeply about leadership and understand what it really is. So to illustrate this principle, let me give you a few examples. Because it's easy to say you agree with something, but then when difficulty or opposition comes, if you cave, it's right to question whether you really believe what you say you did. And this is what happens with servant leadership all the time. People say, yes, we should seek the good of others. But then what happens most of the time, it's in the form of bad policies. And people cave and they don't seek the good of others and instead seek to uphold a policy that is actually harmful for people. So here's some examples of this. One time I was in a gas station. I was on a long bike ride. And I wanted to get a tan, so I wasn't wearing a shirt. So I should have brought my shirt along. So shame on me for that. But I was about 45 minutes away from home. I was really thirsty. It was a hot day. I didn't have a water bottle or anything like that. So I really needed a drink. And I went into a gas station to buy a bottle of water. And the cashier would not sell me the water. That cashier said, we have a policy. No shirt, no shoes, no service. You don't have a shirt on. We can't sell you the water. Now, is that good of her to do? See, at first, it might seem like it is because she was following the rule, right? And we don't want to be rule breakers. That seems bad to be a rule breaker. So maybe she was doing the right thing. She was following the rule. But what was the rule really? What is that rule really trying to get at? And what about the rule, the unwritten rule of natural law, of meeting the needs of others, of helping those who are in need? What about that rule? Why is she forgetting about that? What should she have done in that case? Should she have broken the rule? What she said is, because I actually asked her, I said, well, I'm really thirsty. I'm sorry, I didn't mean not to have a shirt on. Is there a way you can make an exception? She said, no, I could get fired. So what should have happened there? I would argue the first problem was not her following the rule per se. The problem was that management didn't empower her and treat her the proper way, teach her the proper way to interpret that rule. That rule is designed to keep people who are every day maybe coming in without a shirt, they're lessening the, you know, the ethos of the gas station by flagrantly and intentionally coming in without a shirt on. Okay, you can deny service to those people. But what about the guy who's in there by accident and has a need? She needed to be taught by her manager that she is empowered to use her judgment. And see, the thing is, someone who understands servant leadership understands that. Someone who understands servant leadership wouldn't need to go get permission from their boss to sell me the water that I needed to meet my need. They would have realized they are empowered to do the right thing. You should not let policies stand in the way of doing the right thing. And most of the time, if you do let the policy stand in the way of doing the right thing, you're probably misinterpreting the policy. Another example with the airlines. I had this bag that was probably, it weighed, I think it was like 55 pounds, and they had a limit of 50 pounds. And once you get above 50 pounds, you can still take it on the plane, but it costs $100 more. And so I said, is there any way you can make an exception? It's funny, I keep talking about making exceptions to rules. That's the way leaders think, by the way. They're not about disrespecting authority. What they're about is respecting real authority, the authority of truth, and not letting there be excuses for doing the right thing. So I asked if there could be an exception, and she said no. And this is so ironic. I literally couldn't take anything out except this children's curriculum I was carrying back from one church to another. And the children's curriculum was worth $50, and it weighed like 10 pounds. And the extra charge for going over was $100. So it was actually more cost effective to throw away that children's curriculum than to leave it in because of the extra $100 charge over 5 pounds. What a servant leadership mindset would have done in that case. See, every company says it's customer-centered, but the test is what they do in the hard cases. So if that company, that airline, I don't remember which airline it was, if that company had really been customer-centered, they would have said, look, 5 pounds is not a big deal. This is worth it to make the customer happy. And that's going to be good marketing. So this is a test of whether you're using your authority and power for the good of others. Is in a business, is what's good for the customer the tiebreaker? Or are we willing to sacrifice legitimate customer needs in order to make a few extra bucks or uphold the status quo? You need to let the customer be the ultimate tiebreaker. Now, in schools, you don't have customers. You're not a business. You're educating students. Who's the ultimate constituent in a school? It's the students. So the purpose, the role of the school is to make what is good for the students the ultimate guiding principle in how it sets its policies and makes its decisions. And policies that get in the way of what's good for the student should be revised. And it's a beautiful thing when you have policies that exist to enable people to do the right thing and serve people. That's the right use of power. That's power being used to encourage the doing of the right thing. That is a beautiful thing. If we had institutions, churches, and Christian organizations that intentionally developed people-centered policies and institutionalized the doing of good, that would be an incredible thing, a beautiful thing, a wonderful testimony to the gospel. And then, of course, another constituent, though, in the schools is also the teachers. So the administration needs to have the interests of the teachers at heart, but then ultimately the interests of the students. And by treating the teachers well, they will be able to treat the students well. There are a few other key components of gospel-centered leadership. And another one is that it is transformational. And what that means is it sees leadership not simply as getting things done through others, but building people up in the accomplishment of tasks. So you care not just about tasks, but also about people. And sometimes there's this notion that we have to make a choice between serving the person and serving the task. And we can see this in this chart here, which on one axis you have the importance of tasks, and on the other you have the importance of people. And there are people who don't care about getting the task done or about people, and I just call that horrible management. So don't do that. But then there's some people that think, hey, if we're going to get tasks done, we can't care about people. That's for your personal life. We're here to get a job done. So all they care about is the task. And that creates machine-like and miserable organizations that is not affirming and respectful of individual humanity and the image of God in people. But then you got other managers. They just care about people, even at the expense of tasks. They don't have high expectations. They're very permissive. They let people do whatever they want. There's no structure. Is that what I'm advocating? No, that's country club management. And it actually doesn't serve people, because when you don't bring high expectations to people, you're actually not acting in accord with their nature and how they're designed. The problem is most people think they got to choose somewhere on the continuum, that the more importance you place on people, the less importance you can place on tasks. And the less importance you place on tasks, the more importance you place on tasks, the less importance you place on people. And what I want to say is, and this is standard management thinking, I learned this in a class, that's a false dichotomy. The way to lead, the way to manage, is to put equal importance on people and tasks. That's the best way to serve people and the tasks get done better. And that's called transformational leadership. In other words, if people work for you, if you're a school administrator, if you have a staff, your aim is not just to mobilize the staff to get things done, but to build them up in the process of getting things done. That means build up their understanding, tell them why we're doing things the way we are, so that they can increase their capacity. Increase their capacity. And that, by the way, is most efficient in the long run. What I want to do now, there's a whole lot more that can be said on the essence of gospel-centered leadership. But what I want to do is give you a few core systems for leading in this way. If you are in charge of things, you can design things in accord with this. And if you're not, you can support thinking like this. And of course, you can just walk out and adapt this. You don't have to do it exactly the way I'm advocating. The important thing is the transferable principles. So these are systems / principles, kind of. Really, the first two are actually principles and then concrete systems. First is empowerment. Serving the other person and building them up in the accomplishment of tasks means you get rid of the command and control view of leadership. Because that doesn't build people up. That creates order takers. It creates compliance, not engagement. And what we want in our workplaces and Christian organizations is people who are engaged. People who are emotionally committed to their work. Not people who just do what they're told and are in survival mode, trying to get through the day. It's also more loving to treat people this way, to seek to enable them to be engaged rather than just be order takers. And the way that you create intrinsic motivation, the way that you create engagement in the workplace, is by giving people freedom. Freedom. And you're not doing that if you're taking the command and control approach to leadership. So you need to give people the maximum possible amount of freedom. Give them freedom. Now, why can you give them freedom? By the way, here's another way to put it. Give people the right to act and develop their capacity to act. Now, why can you give people freedom? Because you can trust them. You actually can. There are some people who are trusting by nature and some who are not. So what if you're a person who's not trusting by nature, who says, oh, people have to earn my trust? What should you do? Don't be a manager. Become a lawyer. So there's a place for you. Go be a lawyer. Don't be a manager. And seriously, good managers trust people. That's motivating to people. When people feel their managers don't trust them by default, they are demotivated and demoralized, and their work suffers. And a lot of this, by the way, is self-fulfilling, and there's research backing that up, the Pygmalion effect and so forth. It used to be old models of leadership thought that people only worked for a paycheck, and they also thought that most people wanted to avoid work. That's called Theory X. So the view is most people want to avoid work and do the minimum possible. And if that's how you view people, how are you going to lead them and manage them? Through rewards and punishments. the carrots and sticks. Because if you think they want to avoid work, the only way to get them to do work is through coercive power. Threaten them to be that you'll fire them or bring other negative consequences if they don't do what they're supposed to. And then use monetary incentives to create the positive reward. And it turns out the whole history of management in the, especially last century, shows that view of people is wrong. It's actually unchristian even. It's a reductionistic view of people. It views people as merely economic people, as one-dimensional, rather than realizing people are also talented. So there's a mental and intellectual dimension. Social. So there's the interpersonal dimension. And spiritual. They work for meaning as well as a paycheck. And as Christians, of course, the ultimate aspect of the spiritual component of people is a relationship with God. And what management thinkers have realized is you need to manage to the whole person. And I look at that and I say, not only do you get better results when you do that, it's also the right way to treat people. And it's in sync with a Christian view of man, because people are in the image of God. They deserve to be treated with respect and dignity, not treated merely as economic beings that you manipulate through coercive power. So you need to manage the whole person. And to do that, you need to realize you can trust people. And now these scientific management thinkers would say, oh, but if you trust people, they're going to screw around. Everything's going to go wrong. Well, a guy named Douglas McGregor came along and he brought his research together and he articulated what's called Theory X and Theory Y. And that's two different ways of viewing people. And Theory X says is when you think people naturally want to avoid work and do the minimum. And that leads to managing people through rewards and punishments. But there's another way of viewing people. And this is actually the right way. This is the way 96% of people are. Theory Y realizes that most people want to do good work. That work is as natural as play. And under the right conditions, people actually want increased responsibility. That's the way most people are wired. And I would argue that is a reflection of the image of God in people. And because of Theory Y, you can trust people. Because 96% of people are not going to screw around when they are trusted. Instead, they're going to do more work because trust is motivating. Trust is motivating and encouraging, and it leads to the best work. What's interesting about Theory X and Theory Y is that they are self-fulfilling, though. So this is what ruined Detroit. So management in Detroit had a Theory X view of people. And it's what that is, it's the meaning, and it creates the behavior that the managers are expecting. If you expect people to goof off and avoid work, if you have that viewpoint of people, you're going to actually create those behaviors. And then the management would look at people goofing around and doing the minimum and say, see, we're right about people. What's interesting, though, is that Theory Y is also self-fulfilling. If you view people as capable and competent and eager to do good work, they rise to the occasion. So as a leader and a manager, you have incredible influence over the way people operate. And you can trust people, again, because of Theory X and Theory Y. And you want to avoid the horrible dehumanizing Theory X. But there's one possible objection here as I get close to wrapping up. And it's, well, what about the doctrine of sin? Wouldn't the doctrine of sin mean we should hold to a Theory X view as Christians? And the answer is no. That's a misunderstanding of the nature of sin. Sin doesn't mean every person is guilty of every possible sin or every person is as bad as they possibly can be. It means they never have the glory of God as their ultimate motive. So it is entirely consistent to say that 96% of non-Christians actually want to do good work and excel in their jobs. Now, even in excelling, they're still sinning if they're not doing it for the glory of God, which they aren't because they're not Christians. But it's not the same type of sin as trying to avoid work. It's just a different type of sin. And we're coming at things superficially if we say all people are sinners and therefore they all want to avoid work. It's just not true. We need to go beyond stage one and have a broader and more sophisticated understanding of how sin actually plays out. So you can trust people, and that's why you can empower them. So now here are three quick systems to utilize, because good intentions are not enough. You have to weave your good intentions into the fabric of the organization through real practical systems. And one is mission statements. And I think as classical educators, you're especially strong on this. Have a vision for education. And that's what classical education is all about. Doug Wilson's book, Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning, obviously is an excellent book. And I forget which chapter it is, but in here towards the end, he lays out six principles that govern how they think of classical Christian education. Yeah, here it is. The Trivium and the Christian School in chapter 7. There's three principles for what it means to be Christ-centered, and there's three principles on what it means to be classical. That's a vision of education. And a vision unites people. And a vision is what enables people to be empowered. Because another objection someone could make is if you trust people and empower them, they're not going to know what to do. They're not going to have direction. How do you solve that? Answer, you do give them clear direction. Not detailed micromanagement, but you cast a vision. The mission and the values. And then people, and this is the key, are free to manage themselves within the context of that vision. This is a radical change. That goes to the heart of gospel-centered leadership. There is a transfer of power from the leader to the one being led. The leader is no longer a boss, but now a source of help. The leader teaches correct principles so that the follower can manage him or herself in light of those principles. The leader is the source of help. And this is, of course, what Jesus is saying. Let the one who is first among you be the slave of all. To become a slave means you're not the person's boss. So boss-centered command and control leadership is not in sync with what Jesus is saying about leadership. Instead, transferring power, that's what it means to be a slave, to those who are following. That's the essence of gospel-centered leadership. Because the aim is to build them up. Not build yourself up, which is what the exercise of authority does. It's to build them up. Now, is there a place for authority? Yes, of course. But we are to lead chiefly through persuasion, truth, and principles, not command and control. And that means you need to teach principles and mission statements. Clear mission statements for the organization are crucial to how to do that. You can bring that down a level to teams if you have to form committees and create team charters. This team exists for this reason, and here are our values, and here's how we measure our success. So that's the second tool, team charters. And then win-win performance agreements. And this is at the heart. They're often called job profiles, job descriptions. But this term gets at something different about them. Job descriptions are not supposed to be straitjackets that constrict people and micromanage people. They are to give people a helpful structure that allows them to manage themselves in the context of the agreement. It is what allows you to transfer power to those you are leading without falling into anarchy. And that's the key. I'm not advocating anarchy here. I'm not saying don't lead. I'm saying you need to change the way you think about leadership. It's not about dictating. It's not about giving orders. It's about teaching principles and leading people through persuasion and on the basis of truth and saying, we're going to do things this way because here's why. Here's where it's taught in the Bible. Here's the research from Common Grace that shows why this is good. So we're going to operate this way. And then people can direct themselves because they understand the principles and truth. That's the task of the leader. That's what it means to lead for the good of others. You get yourself out of the way between them and God so that now they are free to grow in their character and in their judgment so they can make decisions and become truly mature people. But you give this agreement so that you don't have anarchy. So the expected results and guidelines are clear, and then people are free to manage themselves and they have the structure they need. What are the results of this? Finally, the results of a gospel-centered work environment. Character is built because now you don't have a do-what-you're-told mentality. People have to use their judgment, have to learn and make decisions. That's the building of character. People are motivated because freedom is, Daniel Pink shows us in his book Drive, The Surprising Truth of What Motivates Us. Freedom is actually an essential component of intrinsic motivation. People take initiative because when they're motivated, they take initiative. And then the results are better because you have people taking initiative and thinking hard about the problems in front of them. And they don't have to get approval from 20 different people to act. They can do the right thing. They don't got to be like that woman at the gas station who was not empowered to sell a bottle of water to a thirsty guy. That's bad results. And you better believe I never went back to that gas station again. People will actually love their jobs. This is how you create an environment where people want to go to work and don't just go there because they have to earn a living. And then it has ripple effects into the rest of their lives, their home lives, and society. And this leads to the final and most important result of gospel-centered leadership. And it's this. God's plan for changing the world is love. Not the sentimental, wishy-washy form of love, but the biblical meaning of love. And this is in Ephesians 5, and I can't go in there and do the exegesis, but Peter O'Brien lays this out very effectively in his commentary on Ephesians 5. God's vision for reaching the world is not chiefly for Christians to go off and become missionaries in Africa, and everyone becomes a missionary, though some people have to do that. It's for Christians to stay in their jobs, in their ordinary vocations, and do them in a gospel-centered way. And the teaching of Ephesians 5 is that it is chiefly through our vocations that we bring our faith into the world. And as we do our ordinary daily tasks, including leadership, from love and in a gospel-centered way, those actions have a transforming effect that accompanies our verbal witness to the gospel and causes some people to come to faith. So here's the ultimate result. Think of hundreds and thousands of Christian organizations, Christian ministries, churches, schools, leading themselves in a gospel-centered way, a way based on love. So when people look at these organizations, they are seeing deeds of love abundantly done. And they're seeing policies even which are loving and people-affirming when they're so used to seeing policies that are self-protective and adversarial, policies designed to serve people and make life better. If they see thousands of Christian organizations led that way, they will see an incredible, visible demonstration of the life the gospel calls for. And that will lend credibility to our profession of faith and have a transforming effect. In other words, gospel-centered leadership is at the heart of God's plan for reaching the world for Christ. So thanks so much for being here. If you have any questions or anything, I will be around and enjoy the rest of your afternoon.